The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. I'm Pete Ludovitz here with my ever effervescent co-host, a man who's appalled at the recent 7 × 10⁻¹⁰ dollar bailout with the worsening economy, Bill Hunt.
Yes, I am. I am appalled by that. I am very much appalled, and we have with us today Professor Willie Belton from the School of Economics at Georgia Tech, and I'll give a little bit of intro. We aren't doing science in the news today because the fiscal impact has meant we didn't
have
the funding.
That is science in the news, baby.
We didn't have funding to actually pull together the science in the news today.
We're funded? How much are you getting paid?
That's my story, and I'm going with it. But Professor Belton, his undergraduate degree was from University of South Carolina, where he also played basketball, by the way. And then he went to Penn State to get his Ph.D. in economics. And I don't know that they have a basketball team at Penn State. This is something I've needled him about for years. And he and I joined the faculty at Georgia Tech about the same time, 87.
Yeah,
you're 87. So we've known
it's
pretty much ever since.
It's 1887, I think.
And we've known each other for all that time. And he's also a great dad. I've had a lot of occasions to ask him for his advice about raising two sons, which he's done very effectively. And the topic today is going to be the financial mess that we are in and trying to kind of get our minds around that and understand that. So welcome to the program.
Thank you, Bill.
And just a reminder to our listeners, if you are listening, we will be taking calls in the second half of the show, second half hour. For those of you that are as confused as Bill and I am, are about this whole financial mess. So again, you can give us a call in the second half of the hour at 404-894-2468. Once again, that's 404-894-2468. Or that number is posted on the website if you're listening online at wrek.org.
Even though I've got it written on a list on the agenda, maybe let's talk a little bit about what economics is these days. So it's actually very mathematical. So what are the different branches within economics, would you say?
Well, there are a number of branches. I'm a macroeconomist, which means that I worry about the large issues, inflation, unemployment, and that sort of thing. We also have a micro side, which is basically worrying about consumers and businesses and business development and how they behave, profit maximization. We have specialties that are broken out even more precisely in terms of one of the things that we specialize in here at Georgia Tech is industrial organization, where we examine market structure and those kinds of issues. We also have a specialty in international economics, where we look at how international phenomenon impact our own economy as well as how our economy impacts the economy of others.
And voodoo economics, where would that be?
that was a term coined by the first George Bush during the election against Reagan. He was the one that coined that phrase. But so it's very mathematical, correct? For a good bit of it, not all of it?
It can be. Over the last 15 or 20 years, it's become pretty mathematical. But I would argue that over the last probably 10 years, we're getting back to much more, common questions, in that we're trying to figure out how it is that economics can say something and provide insights as to how people live daily. So it's certainly it is mathematical, but we're really trying to become more relevant.
And there's been a so that econometrics, is that the right term for the sort of highly mathematical?
Well, econometrics is really just statistical applications, right, in the sense that we apply statistics to economics and we run regressions. Because, you know, many times, Bill, you and I have talked about time series analysis. You look at current going through a wire and I look at the money supply flowing through a country.
Right.
So it's very similar. We use similar tools.
So that was what I was trying to get out was that it is a science and there's a mathematical construct. There's also this sort of case study and historical aspect. But even with the historical aspect, you can go back and get data number of loans made
or whatever else.
So it's all kind of out there.
But we do that as well, right? I mean, the case study approach was sort of invented by Harvard for business schools, but we do case studies on safety. You know, things like that in engineering as well.
Right. And the other thing I was going to point out, that a lot of times with what you have in economics, it's noisy data. So it's not really clear, just glancing at it, what the what the nugget of information is.
That's
part of what your signal processing, if we would call that electrical engineering. You pull out from this very noisy data the information. So
that's precisely right.
So, all right. So this financial mess that we're in,
is that the technical term for it, Bill? Mess.
Yeah, mess.
I want to ask our guest: is there a better technical term for this that will impress people at cocktail parties?
Money egressing from my wallet. Mess. I don't know. Okay, I got to figure out what the two S's are. But what kind of a mess is this? Is this,
and can we blame Bill for it? That's the real question.
George W. Can we blame George W. for it?
Always with the Bush, though,
isn't
it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, primarily, the mess that we're in stems from regulatory agencies sort of going to sleep at the wheel at one level, and at another level, just old-fashioned greed. So I I'm not really sure that I call it a mess as much as a market correction that's going to be a very large one. So it's not something that's not happened before. We have market corrections all the time. This one is being publicized quite a bit, and the Great Depression pales by what's happening now. And it's purely because our markets are so much bigger. If you think the market for derivatives in the world is something on the order of $500 to $800 trillion.
Okay, a derivative market is what exactly?
Derivatives are these manufactured securities.
Right. These weird. Okay, so this is like a side bet in Vegas, is what a derivative is.
Well, hedge funds and these kind of, and they're trying to hedge risk. So you use options and futures to hedge your risk. In other words, you try to buy insurance, and that's what they amount to.
Derivative, is that like the calculus derivative? So you're dealing on a slope. It's not related to that.
Not quite. This is a financial asset that you can actually buy.
Okay.
And it's sort of a derivative of a main financial asset.
Yes.
Right.
It's a derivative in the sense that it's derived from value that's under it.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So the how did we? You were talking about this a little bit before the program, but how do we get to this point?
Primarily, let me start where most people would recognize the mortgage industry. When guys like us were young fellows, our parents bought homes and they went out and got a mortgage, and they got a mortgage from the local savings and loan or the local bank, and the local bank did the underwriting. Now, underwriting is just investigating the creditworthiness of the borrower. And this was a very, very thorough process.
And is it fairly safe to say that the bank would not allow you to buy a house way beyond your means?
Oh, certainly.
So you didn't have somebody making $30,000 a year living in a $300,000 home.
Couldn't do it. Because you think about it, the bank was worried about the money that belonged to the community. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't lose the community's money and expect to stay in business. So it would be very difficult to make a loan to a guy that he couldn't afford, and the high probability of default was there. So you'd have to have an exorbitant interest rate, and there was no way to do this, really. But primarily what happened in that whole market was that once a mortgage was made, it was very specific and illiquid. What I mean by that is they're very difficult to sell. because they had bells and whistles, and each mortgage was different. So we had secondary markets, that and these are the markets, much like the New York Stock Exchange, where you could sell mortgages. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were created for that very purpose, to buy these mortgages. So the bank literally could sell, or the savings and loan literally could sell its mortgage, but it wasn't on a grand scale like we have today. But in the 80s and 90s, along come the big investment banks from Wall Street, and they said, guys, we can show you how to make those mortgages valuable so that they can actually trade in the marketplace. And basically, we created something called a mortgage-backed security. And all this is, in simple terms, is a bundle of mortgages.
Now, is that considered a derivative, this mortgage?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Right.
So
yes.
Something
yes.
derived from an original yes. debt investment
that's,
vehicle.
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Cool.
So we have these big bundles of mortgages, and initially they were valuable, but the market wasn't really crazy about them. It was only when we came up with this trenching scheme where we tiered these things, and if default happened, the guy who bought the Tier 5 mortgages or mortgage-backed security, he had to pay up first, or he lost his money first.
So I'm not understanding. So the tier would be, so you start with your local savings and loan has let's say $1 million worth of mortgages. Mm-hmm. So in other words, that's the amount that has to get paid off, let's say.
Right.
And so they bundle those up and sell that
to an investment banking house.
Okay.
Or they could sell it to Fannie Mae or
something. And so then that means the burden of worrying about whether or not the person's actually going to pay off the loan or not is removed from that bank that had it originally.
That's right. And it's mainly,
and so now it's somebody else's problem to worry about that, but and it's somebody else's profit.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Now, the bank does get a little bit of profit in this process. I mean, because he has all the underwriting stuff, the origination fees and all those things go to the original guy originating the mortgage. So he's not broken this. He's getting money out of this deal. But primarily these mortgage-backed securities became a very hot property when they sort of divided them into tiers. And the fifth tier is theoretically where the most risky mortgages.
And so by tier, this is a classification of the quality of the mortgage?
That's exactly right.
Okay, so these are like this AA and AAA rating scheme that we hear.
That's exactly right. And tier one was rated AAA because the probability of default was really low.
So those were the best in terms of most secure.
So like a really secure bond or something is
AAA. That's exactly what it's
AAA. So is a government security typically AAA?
Yeah.
So at least maybe not now.
That can be a little tricky now. But usually government securities are thought of, particularly treasury bonds. We in finance you say they're the risk free asset because they don't have theoretically they don't have much risk. Now what ended up happening when we got this trunching scheme where we have the top level being AAA, these things are very safe, and now you could trade them. Right now, these became liquid assets. You could trade them, you borrow against them, the whole deal. Everybody loved them. Wall Street loved them. All the investors loved them because they paid well.
Yeah, because the housing market was so darn good.
Oh, and the housing market was incredible.
Well, and then so let's so in terms of the value of that, you got $1 million from the local savings and loan, let's say, for this. Or the local bank, but over the course of this 30-year loan, if it all pays out, that's really going to be $5 million.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because you think about it, if you got a 30-year mortgage.
Mm-hmm. A lot of interest.
You pay three times.
Right. So that's part of the beginning of the something for nothing aspect of this, would you say? So the bank put out, basically loaned you the, $100,000 for your house with the idea that over the course of 30 years, they're going to collect $500,000.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
okay?
Well, it's
but
a
now
good,
the big corporation is getting $5 million over the course of 30, but they're not going to keep it 30 years either.
Right, right. Okay. So, but these things become very liquid. You can sell them, right? All before, your mortgage was sitting there, and it was so specific that it was illiquid. These things, these mortgage-backed securities, everybody knows what they are, and they're like bonds.
Did something have to change in the regulation to allow people to start selling those?
Well, now, the mortgage-backed security market was not regulated at all. This is the Wild Wild West.
Okay.
Right? I mean, these are...
But this is kind of a general trend, though. When something's brand new,
right,
there are no regulations on it.
Well, but on the other hand, you have to think about the way that our system is set up. If only the rich guys are going to play in this system, our government is saying, okay, this is the free market. Let them play. If they lose their money, they're wealthy, they can...
Right. Yeah. These aren't regular
homeowners. They can come to Congress and ask for $700 billion.
Well, that's theoretically, that's not the way the free market works. It's
what happened, but it's not, yeah.
Right.
I'm still laughing over this.
Yeah.
but we didn't regulate this thing. It was the Wild Wild West. You could do almost anything that you wanted to. So these mortgage-backed securities were running around everywhere. Now, the tricky part of this is that I told you these things are five tiers. Well, because we wanted to sell even more of these mortgage-backed securities, we decided to take tier three and break it out into something called collateralized debt obligations.
So tier three, AAA would be you borrowing to buy a house, you've got a tenured faculty position, you're going to pay it off. Tier three is, somebody who doesn't necessarily, is it that somebody may not be able to pay
it
off?
But because there's a bundle.
Interest only? Because
there's a bundle of these things, there are interest only mortgages up and down the tiers.
Mm-hmm.
But these people in tier three probably have a higher probability of default.
Okay.
Than people in tier one.
Got it. Okay.
Now, see, and you can't think of these things as individual mortgages because it's a huge bundle of them.
Right.
Right. You don't know whose mortgage is in there. That's one of the real problems in the marketplace right now. When people start to default, it's sort of, we don't know which mortgage-backed security is being hit. Because they're big and there's a lot of them, so it's very difficult to determine.
Which gets to the point that Pete was talking about, whereas, the right wing wants to point at poor people are the source of the problem, but nobody knows. I mean, it's all
right.
That's not the issue.
And they admit they don't understand what's in what.
Right.
I think the worst thing that we can do in this crisis is start to point fingers at who did what and that sort of thing. Because primarily, there's enough blame to go around. I mean, the regulators mm-hmm. went to sleep at the wheel. Certainly, in their quest for profits, the investment banks went after it as aggressively as they possibly could. You really can't blame consumers who took loans based on a strategy that had worked before.
Right.
And let me sort of give you the strategy that I'm talking about. You decided, let's suppose Bill Hunt, the electrical engineering professor, decides that he wants $1 million house. Whether he needs it or not is immaterial. He wants $1 million house. And some guy comes to you and say, Bill, listen, I can get you in that $1 million house, but it's only going to cost you $3,000 a month for the first 5 years. And what we're going to do is refinance that for you. As your salary grows and as this thing appreciates, we can get better terms. So primarily because the marketplace was behaving in such a way that this $1 million house was appreciating, and it was in California, one of those really hot markets, it could really appreciate, right? So 3 years from now, that $1 million house that Bill Hunt bought is now worth $1.6 million. Well, anybody would refinance this mm-hmm. for you. Right, because man, this guy has $600,000 worth of equity in this thing.
Right,
so I'll give you $1 million loan against it. This is what they're telling people. Now, the implicit assumption here is that the house is going to increase in value. That's the implicit assumption.
Mm-hmm.
Had it? Yeah, and historically for 70 years, yeah. the houses had gone up in value. So do you take the deal? Bill Hunt says, yeah, that sounds like a reasonable deal because Willie Belton down the street just did it with
he's got that big house.
Well,
yeah,
he just did it with a $500,000 house, and it worked for him. So he said, okay, this is good. So you try it. Well, nobody knew or you couldn't quite envision the housing market sort of stopping in its tracks and all the appreciation stopping. So, okay, that $1 million house you got, sorry guys, it's not worth $1 million. It's only worth $800,000 now. But you got $1 million mortgage on it. So at this point, unless you can cough up $200,000 from somewhere, you can't get anybody to refinance it for you.
Right.
Right? Because the value went down.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're stuck in this crazy loan that's resetting every year. This is what happened to most Americans who we say, okay, they bought a house that was too big or whatever. Certainly, they probably overextended themselves. You would probably look at this house and say, I don't need $1 million house, right? But it's very tempting.
Right. So Bill might have bought a smaller house, gotten a fixed interest rate mortgage, whereas most of these have some kind of variable, after these few years, adjustable rate, balloon payment,
which you think
you can make because you're going to make a lot in the equity on the appreciation.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And just to look at the way the perception has changed, I mean, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for young people to get into a house and be house poor.
Right.
So they could make the payment. Now, it wasn't an interest-only loan.
Right.
They could make a payment, but they were eating a lot of ramen noodles and peanut butter crackers for years until they made enough where they could live on top of that.
See, I think we've lost some of that mentality, right? So I moved to my house, and I've got a really low fixed interest mortgage. But I didn't have furniture in the living room for 10 years.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people are like, I got to buy this, I got to buy that. So they buy it all on credit. They got this large credit card debt. Mm-hmm. Or they take a home equity loan after a few years when they get equity. Sure. And, you know, the only debt I have is my house.
Right.
And I didn't even have card debt until, my escort finally died. And now I've got a short-term low-interest loan from the state credit union for 4 years, and that'll be paid off. And it's a small car, so it's a small loan. I don't think people do that. I think we're trying to keep up with the Joneses a little bit too much. And that's just one contribution.
Right.
Maybe
and you saw it, but I knew people that would get a more house than they really could afford, and how they dealt with that was not eating as much and on and on and on. So,
but you've never had that problem, Bill.
And that's all based on this notion that you're going to grow into the house, it's going to appreciate, and you're going to be able to eventually sell it for more than you paid.
Right.
And certainly, listen, I'm not making excuses for people who overextended themselves, because that's a bad idea. Mm-hmm. But given the history of the housing market, right, we sort of believe that these things are going to appreciate. So you buy a house a little bit bigger than you need. And then you get great tax treatment, right? Because think about it. You write off all the interest on your mortgage. So the bigger, the more
Our entire payment is interest. So
this is a very tempting notion. It really is. Now, still, I'm not excusing people for living beyond their means. Not by any stretch. But basically, the mortgage holders and the sellers of real estate and that sort of stuff, they were out there tilling the soil, getting people to come in to do this. Because we needed more mortgages to create more mortgage-backed securities.
Right, and you were, a phrase you used much earlier before the show is this, they needed people to keep stoking the fire. So they needed to be selling mortgage to somebody, anybody, to keep this other machine going. So really back to your other, I was trying to understand the details there. But yeah, it's not any one group's fault.
No.
And not to put words in your mouth, but essentially the finger pointing isn't going to fix the problem, and we got a problem.
Not at all. It's not going to fix the problem at all. And finger pointing is really stupid. But let me jump ahead of the story a little bit, because the real problem in a credit market is this. There are these things called CDSs, which they're called credit default swaps. And what it really is, it's an insurance policy. You can't call it insurance because if you call it insurance, you have to regulate it. It's really a put option. And what happens there is that you're buying insurance that says let's use a bond, for instance, that if this bond defaults, my insurance is going to pay. Right? So you're covering yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, there is something on the order of 200 to 300 trillion of these things. The reason that our government bailed out Bear Stearns is that they didn't want these CDSs to go bad. They had to get in there and say, wait, we can't let this go bad.
$300 trillion worth of them?
Ouch. Dollars. And let me give you a sense of how much that is. Total GDP, gross domestic product, in the world is somewhere between 40 and about $70 trillion in a year.
Holy Moses.
World. Right?
Wow.
So this gives us insight into how much debt there really is.
This is how
floating
big this,
around the US.
This is how big this market is. Right? I don't want to call it debt in a true sense because if you don't default on the bond,
mm-hmm.
then you don't have to pay
okay.
the insurance,
yeah.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't want to think of it that way.
But even if a fraction of these defaulted,
right.
it's so big.
This huge, huge market. And what they're doing with AIG, what they're doing with Bear Stearns, all of these big investment houses, they have a ton of these things. So you can't let these things go down the tubes. Because the world will be in financial crisis, as it is now, right? And the world is in financial crisis primarily because of lack of confidence. Nobody is going to loan to anybody because they don't know whether they're going to get paid back.
So it's almost like a big catch-22.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Do we need to take a break?
Yeah, we can take a quick break.
Because okay. I'm absolutely I'm more horrified than I was before.
We were hoping to calm Pete down, but it's not working out.
I'm much
that
more
way.
Horrified. But nonetheless, yeah. you're listening okay. to Professor Willie Belton from the School of Economics here on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta. We'll be right back after this break.
More groovy sounds? Tune in Saturday night from 8 to 10 p.m. for the Saturday Night Cocktail Lounge.
Tune in to the New Forces Radio Hour, spinning rock and roll records every Tuesday night, 11 to midnight, following Live at Rec, right here on 91.1 FM, WREK.
It was down in the valley, so low. It was where I held on you so tight. How did I ever let you go?
Craziest electronic music, tune in every Wednesday evening here on WRNK Atlanta from 7 to 9 p.m. to the Mobius.
Join your host, Matt and Josh, on a space ride through future fun. From industrial to IDM, from noise core to bit rock, dub, ambient, and everything in between.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking with Professor Willie Belton from the School of Economics here at Georgia Tech, who is attempting to apply economic theory to assuage my horror over the current economic crisis.
Yeah, I need some screams in the background or something like that. The number, if you'd like to call in and ask your question and help you to understand it, is 404-894-2468. Let's see, we were, you know, one question is, how did this thing get to be global? So
wait, let's hear that number once again of the amount of, what were these things called again? These credit
derivatives.
CDSs?
Yeah, CDSs. Okay. Yeah. Something on the order of 200 to 300 trillion.
And the gross domestic product worldwide is 1/10 of that.
Yes. Well, let me say this. The GDP of the United States is $14 trillion in a year.
Okay.
So that tells you. Right. And the United States is the largest economy on Earth. Right? So we're just marginally smaller than all of Europe combined.
Wow.
Okay. So you got my attention.
Right. It's a big number. Yes.
A huge number.
Yes. So, all right. So how did it get to be global?
Well, primarily, there's lots of exposure. All financial markets are global now. So there are people buying mortgage-backed securities that are everywhere, right? It's just not in the United States. As well as when our firms started to go get capital strapped, in other words, they couldn't borrow, they started borrowing in the international market. The Chinese are holding a bunch of our debt. So it's everywhere. These markets are not partitioned by boundaries, by geographical boundaries.
Were they prior to the Great Depression, or did you have the same kind of international?
Oh, for sure. Much more compartmentalized. We did not have international financial markets prior to the Great Depression like we have now. And plus, communications devices has helped us, right? I mean, mm-hmm. The internet and all this stuff, you can move information really fast. You get information really fast. Everybody has the same information. Markets are interlocked all around the world. So it's we couldn't. The United States, the United States is the big kahuna. It's the big guy. If it starts to go down, it's like water going down a drain. It's going to start sucking people in. Right?
And that's again, he's not making me feel better about this situation.
Let me clean it up a little bit for you. Mm-hmm. Is all lost? The answer is no. Absolutely not. We have to be sure that we can stop the fall in the value of property, real estate. In other words, houses and that sort of stuff. They got to quit depreciating. When your house reaches its final number, whatever that is, maybe a 10% drop, 15% drop, 20% drop, then all of the shaking at the bottom will stop. But this is a correction. Real estate was overvalued. Now it's correcting. It's going to happen.
Okay, so what you're saying is my house will be worth less, my investments, my retirement will be worth less, but hopefully it'll stop and come back as opposed to go down the drain and we'll have mass hysteria, dogs and cats living together, you know, that sort of
right.
stuff.
Right. What I'm hoping is within the next 6 to 18 months, things will settle down.
Okay.
And now, I think Congress and
is the settling out primarily, or if you had to, what I think I hear you saying is if you had to point to one thing that would help it settle out, it would be for housing values to stop dropping.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Because that's sort of, again, there's kind of this imaginary money thing going on, so it's not like you took money, a $20 bill out of your wallet, and now suddenly that's mysteriously $15. It's more like you have this loan to pay off of $1 million, and now your house is only worth $800,000, and so you're going to be, even if you sold this house today, you'd owe $200,000.
That's exactly right.
So that's where the kind of the imaginary, well, it's real, but I mean, it's where the value prospect or the perception of how much the house is worth is...
It's sort of like, these are called wealth effects, right? In the sense that, let's say you're sitting here now and your portfolio of stocks and bonds and whatever else is worth $5 million. And something happens on the stock market, and the next day it's only worth $2.5 million. You feel more poor.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to feel more poor, you consume differently. You stop buying mm-hmm. stuff. You stop shopping at Walmart or wherever, right? And this makes everything sort of download.
Right.
So it's these wealth effects that we're worried about.
Well, we're at the Hunt household part of the problem because for a variety of reasons we pretty much have stopped eating out in restaurants.
Bills have been buying the generic hair gel now, so that's a big deal.
I'm not going to go that low. I will always consume decent hair gel, I assure you. Not to worry, you know, with people out there selling hair gel to start getting concerned. But I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, it's a fact. I mean, so at a local level within my own family, you know, my kids actually are starting to cook. My wife's a good cook. I'm a good cook. So we're not eating out
right
as much as we might have like 5 years ago. And part of it is this perception. It's not, I mean, the money we've got every month hasn't changed
right.
at all.
Right.
But we go, whoa, things are bad out there. Let's not go out to eat tonight.
But gas prices did take a little out of your budget.
Oh, yeah, they did.
Right, they did take a little out of your budget. And you see commodity prices now coming mm-hmm. down. And that's reduction in demand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not eating out anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't drive
quite as much. Right.
I don't drive nearly as much.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I reduced my driving consumption this year by 12,000 miles.
Oh, yeah. I believe it. I'm taking MARTA on a pretty regular basis now. So.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
Hmm. This is hopefully not really switching too much, but the $700 billion bailout.
Yeah, so we got 40 minutes left. We want to talk about the solution. Was this
okay, you don't want to do that. Okay.
No, that is one of the 10.
Yeah. Okay.
Was that a good solution? Should we do something else?
I think Paulson and Bernanke are doing exactly what they should be doing. Just started a little late, right? In other words, we probably should have started this earlier. You want to put money into these institutions so that the liquidity comes back. So that the capital comes back, the cash is back, so people can borrow and that sort of stuff. What really started to happen here over the last half year or so is that nobody would loan anybody any money. And just as we were talking about earlier, in a commercial paper market where these are really, really short-term things and people borrow for, you know, small businesses borrow to pay their workers because receipts and outflows mm-hmm. don't match up.
Oh, okay. So you're talking about even in this short-term commercial paper market.
Oh, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. All the credit dried up. So how does a small firm borrow to make ends meet?
So let me ask you that. I mean, I was wondering, and you know, another one of my, in addition to my bashing the Bush administration, another one that gets me is the media. That they don't really get to the essence of a problem. But how much of the crisis we were having in gasoline was due to a shortage? You know, how do these service stations operate? Do they, because everybody else had plenty of gas in the country, but we didn't. So would you see things? I don't know what was going on there.
You mean in Georgia in particular?
Yeah,
just a few weeks ago.
So was the short-term credit crisis problem something that might impact grocery stores to be able to get, I mean, how do they operate? Do they pay their bills 30, 90 days out and somebody's going, nope, not 90 anymore. We're going to need this like right when we walk in the door. I mean, how is that starting
Let me start with the whole fuel thing here in Georgia. There's a couple of things running around in there. One, there was a pipeline that was not working. And they're bringing that pipeline back online. We were really aggressive in Georgia and in many states in the Southeast in pursuing people who gouge. In other words, we didn't let the price move as readily as it probably could have. And so that, along with the busted pipeline, really did cause shortages in Atlanta and in a lot of
Georgia. Yeah, and we depend on only that pipeline here in the Southeast, whereas New England has at least an additional source.
Right. So that was a problem. The whole uptick in oil prices over the summer and so forth and so on, a lot of that stuff's caused by expectations. I mean, you think about it. There's a hurricane that's going to hit in the Gulf. People get really scared, and they start to say, oh, man, it's going to knock out all the oil platforms and that sort of stuff. So they start to say, well, oil is going to be scarce. Prices are going to rise. So you're going to have prices bumping up and down. So expectations drive a lot of this stuff. Sometimes they're out of whack. And you know, they sort of run away with it.
Where out of whack is the technical term.
Well, it's not the technical term.
Well, no, but you just hit the nail on the head with regard to how economics is different than, say, electrical engineering or chemistry or something like that, that you have this human effect, confidence.
Perception.
You know, perception.
That's
are
right.
you out of whack? Are you scared?
Right.
That, you know, if Bill's in a bad mood, the impedance of his circuit is still basically the same with very little fluctuation.
Right. Yeah.
That's going to make this feel tough.
It is. It is very tough. And it's primarily trying to forecast what consumers are going to do. And we can't do it very well. I mean, we can do long-term forecasting, but short-term forecasting is very, very difficult.
Right.
Just as you can't predict the market on a day-to-day basis. It's a random walk. It's noisy. Right, mm-hmm. It bounces up, and it's just as likely to go up as it is to come down. So it's very difficult to predict. And anybody who tells you he can do short-term prediction, tell him, you know.
So I'm not to believe those late-night infomercials with a guy on the yacht going, just send $940 for my system, and you'll be good to go.
No.
All right.
That doesn't work.
But does the short-term debt drying up, how does that affect local? So I've never had a business, so I don't know. You know, that if I had a 7-Eleven or, you know, Dairy Queen or whatever, am I not going to be able to get things in? I mean, how does the money flow work with a small business?
Let's say Bill Hunt owns a small factory and he has to pay his workers. He has 100 workers. And he sells to Walmart and they pay only every 60 days. But you got to pay your workers every week, every month. Mm-hmm. Well, you can go into the short-term market and borrow. You have a line of credit, whatever. You can borrow, right? Your line of credit is $100,000. You just go borrow it and pay it. Well, if you go to your bank and they say, well, Bill, I tell you the truth, we got to hold on to our cash because our balance sheet is a little strange, and I'm going to tell you what that means in a minute. Now your line of credit dries up. How are you going to pay your workers?
Right.
That becomes a problem. Because when you go and you tell George, well, you know, George, I really can't pay you this week.
But I got extra hair gel for you.
Right. He is not going to be happy.
An entire jar.
Right. He's not going to be happy.
Right.
But the interesting thing about what happened to institutions that own these mortgage-backed securities. Let's say if an institution was leveraged 10 to 1. So for every dollar of owner's equity, he had $10 of assets, right? And let's suppose something happens, and it loses $2 of assets. And let's put this in billions so that it'll make sense. $100 billion in assets, $90 billion in liabilities, $10 billion in owner's equity. Now, something happens in his assets, he loses $2 billion. Now he has $98 billion in assets, he has still the $90 billion in liabilities, but he only has $8 billion in owner's equity. Here's the problem. If his leverage is 10 to 1 by law, he has $98 billion in assets and only $8 billion in owner's equity. That's a problem for him. He has to sell $18 billion in assets. He's got to sell them to somebody. This is what happened to all the institutions at the same time. So it was a fire sale. Everybody's trying to sell exactly at the same time, and nobody's buying because you got to hold on to all of your cash because you got to make this 10-to-1 leverage work.
Right.
So all of a sudden there is no excess cash anywhere. Everybody's holding it.
Not under the couch.
Well, maybe under your couch, but not under mine. But so it becomes very, very difficult. So all of the credit markets just tighten up. Now I heard on the news this morning on CNN that the credit markets are thawing. And what that really means is people are getting a little bit more, a little bit less skeptical, and they're loaning to people. But we got to have those credit markets work. If they don't work, and this is similar to you go down to your bank, you have a line of credit with your bank, and you write a $1,000 check because you got to have some extra money for something, and they tell you, you know, guy, it was here yesterday, but it's gone. We can't do that for you. What would you do? I mean, what would you say to your banker after you choked him? Right. I mean, you know,
I was waiting for the reference to physical violence.
Right. And if the baby
starts breathing again.
Yeah. How would you fix this? Right?
Yeah.
All right. So we got about 10 minutes left here. The question is, what about the solution? You had implied before that what Paulson and Bernanke are doing is the right thing.
It's a little
late, but good.
Yeah, it's the right thing to do. We have to make the credit markets work. In other words, we have to be sure that when Bill Hunt, who owns his little factory, goes down to the bank to get $100,000, that he can get it, so that he can pay his workers and his workers can keep consuming and they can keep paying their mortgages. Right? We gotta have that. And to some degree, that's what Paulson and Bernanke are doing. They're trying to put the money where it can do the most good. Now, one of the things that they have to be very, very careful about is that we don't have a scenario like these AIG guys who they gave a huge sum of money to, and then these guys went and had a $400,000 junket. I mean, that's really stupid. Mm-hmm. I mean, talking about...
So that's that greed part you were talking about before the show.
Yeah, you know, it's probably... In their case, it was probably not as much greed as... Think of it this way. They're planning to go off and have a meeting to discuss how they can attack this problem, right? And in any other situation, nobody cares,
right?
They go off, have the meeting, they come back with a new strategy.
And they do things the way they've always had them,
right.
Which is probably this is not any more
that's right. Any
less than they would have ever paid for this kind
that's
of meeting.
That's exactly
the point. I got Georgia Tech checking out my Taco Bell receipt for my last trip.
Well, with good reason. You didn't need the cheese. I've been around you. You don't need the cheese.
But the point of it is, they do this. And it's because taxpayer money has gone in here. And taxpayers...
Right. If they're profitable and they're spending their profits on that,
yes,
that's okay.
Yes. Yeah.
So the solution then is to do this infusion of capital to literally lubricate these credit
markets.
That's exactly
what we have.
Now, what about fixing that? I mean, so it sounds to me like there's plenty of, again, not getting into the blame game because that just gets to be counterproductive.
But you enjoy it so.
Yes, I do. So how do we, I mean, it seems to me like, you know, being the simplistic engineer, let's get rid of all this. Let's go back to the days of if I got a mortgage, it's with my bank, and I can look the banker in the eye, and he can go, you know what, I'm not going to, you know.
Yeah, so
you're not
going
to be able to afford that addition on your house or
whatever.
Regulate
mortgage securities.
Well, the thing is, all we have to do is get back to good, solid underwriting standards.
Okay.
That's what we have
so
to do.
So a mortgage security is okay as long as the probability of default is low.
Right.
Because you verified, one, the guy has an income,
he has
assets,
right.
He put money
right.
down, life is
so
good.
We don't need to get rid of the selling the mortgages to
No. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, being a secondary market, they've made mortgages available to lots of people.
And that was their purpose.
That otherwise wouldn't have had them. Yeah. I guarantee you all of our fathers bought their first house based on some government program.
Oh, yeah, World War II veterans.
So the VA or FHA or something.
Right.
All of them did.
Right.
So those things aren't inherently bad, not by any stretch. Now, what we have to be very careful about is that we don't incentivize the market to do really odd things or things that's not in our best interest. I'm I'm a free marketeer, guys. I'm not a government regulation guy, government in every corner and that kind of thing. I think the free market is a wonderful idea, right? I think it's wonderful. But I think you have to be really careful with it, particularly when governments intervene in places that they probably shouldn't, but at the same time when government takes a hands-off approach to certain things where we probably ought to get in there and do something. So I know it sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, and to some degree, I guess I am. But free markets are very good. We have been productive. The United States economy has been a wonderful economy, a shining example of what can happen. But we have these corrections from time to time, and things get a little out of hand. But not nearly as much as, you know, the politicians and these guys want to make it. I mean, we start pointing fingers and saying, well, I heard one of my students tell me that if we didn't have Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, this never would have happened. Well, Fannie Mae has been around since 1938,
right,
and Freddie Mac has been around since 1970. And we didn't have the big crash right then, right? Mm-hmm. So we can't really lay this at the feet of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It's a little bit of bad stuff for all of us. We're buying houses that we can't afford. The market creates processes where we can actually do this. We find ways to finance bigger and bigger houses and that sort of stuff. Our tax structure encourages us to buy bigger houses.
Right.
And primarily our economy has been construction industry has been used as an employment generator.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we build houses, people have jobs, they go buy stuff from Walmart, and the economy goes well.
Right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with our economic engine.
Mm-hmm.
It just gets out of whack when we don't pay attention as carefully as we should.
Right. Okay, so we got 5 minutes left, and that brings us to the section of the program, what have we learned? Hopefully a lot here, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so let me see if I can summarize this, and you just jump in and correct me and tell me if I'm nuts at any point. That
you're
experiencing now. Thank
you're,
you.
You're
That's
crazy.
The preemptive nut.
Oh,
I'm calling.
Sorry.
We're experiencing a correction. It's a major correction. It's
going
to last for
it
a
is.
While.
It is.
But it is the result. So no one group can be blamed. This is
all
sorts of factors that brought into this thing, stemming from, you know, this mortgage-centered security issue and the fact that we assumed for three-quarters of a century that housing prices will still go up.
That's right.
And when they leveled off, everything fed into everything else, and we had all sorts of problems, right?
Right.
And that the way to do it is to lubricate these credit markets, which this 7 times 10 to the 11th dollar infusion that Paulson and Bernanke have been pushing is probably a good thing. Maybe a little too late.
It is.
Okay. And you think we'll see what? Improvement in what? 6 to 18 months, you were
saying? Right. I don't think we'll have dramatic
improvement.
There won't be wild times at Ridgemont High, as I call it, right? I mean, we won't be spending money like we were just a few years ago. There's a major correction. Americans will have to change the way that we live. We can't live on credit as much as we have in the past. We'll probably have to buy houses that are more reasonable in size and things that we can pay for,
right,
and that sort of thing. And you have to realize the market and it's an international process now. It's no longer just us or by ourselves. What happens here feeds into the rest of the world. What happens there feeds into us.
Right.
So it's not this isolated place.
And this is this shudders through the economy of the entire world.
That's exactly right.
That we're seeing. And then hopefully when this thing sort of levels out, the true long-term solution is to go back to decent underwriting standards where we give out mortgages based on sound science, for lack of a better, sound cliche.
Right.
And despite all this mess and these shutters throughout the international economy, Bill, you'll be pleased to know, is still using high-quality hair gel.
Yes, I am. I'm not. So you people that make that stuff, don't worry.
Anything else we needed to add here?
No, I think I will have to say thank you to Professor Belton. I understand what's going on a lot better, and, you know, I feel better that there is a reasonable set of things that can get done.
Sure.
Whereas if you just listen to the screaming pundits on various news stations, it sounds like we should all just jump out of a Wall Street window or something like that. I mean, it's hard to, you know, and the blame game and pointing fingers doesn't tell us where the solution
right.
is. Absolutely.
Right.
So.
Okay. All right. So thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
All right. Next week, we believe, we're still monkeying with the schedule. That's the official term there. We'll probably have Wendy Cock from Kimberly-Clark, along with a couple of my students, Sarah Begley and Ashley Newton, talking about a new report released by the Atlanta chapter of the Society of Women's Engineers about diversity in engineering. I'm going to be this Friday at the Relapse Theater at 8 p.m. doing stand-up comedy with a new weekly show up there. And we were trying to give away some tickets, but we did not get anyone calling in. Were the phones on, Trent?
I believe so.
Okay, as far as I know. And maybe people were just so riveted by this economic discourse. If you do have a question, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org, and we will make sure that Professor Belton gets that, and perhaps he can answer your question. In fact, the first three people that send me an email, I'll give you passes for two to Friday Night's Comedy Show at the Relapse Theater on 14th Street in Atlanta. Thanks again for listening to Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier, here on WREK Atlanta.